All right, so again, thank you very much for taking that early time out of bed, coming, showing up here, supporting me. We're here to talk about one of those subjects that are kind of raw. It's not a lot of technical, not a lot of demos that I'm going to have. So hopefully by end of the session, you will still be awake. So what we want to talk about is one of those subjects that comes up a lot of times. It's about mailbox quotas. And assuming that a lot of you people here are here for that reason, you either had a discussion for mailbox quotas, you either wanted to have the discussions, didn't go the way you wanted with your management, or you're management and you're trying to understand why your exchange engineers keep asking for mailbox quotas, why can't we just go with the big mailbox? Right, so let me start with my introduction. I am Robert Gillis. Oh, wait. If any of you went to his session, then I'm Bhargav Shukla. If you like the session, that's who I am. If you don't, just pick any of the other speakers when you're filling out the surveys. I'm Bhargav Shukla. I work with Microsoft. I've been here for about 4 years now. Have worked on Exchange for about 15 years. My primary technology is Exchange, and I also now support Link. So, as the Link guys call it, Exchange is a delayed IAM. All right, so what are we going to talk about today? Quite a few things. Why do we need to talk about mailbox sizing? Why do we need to talk about quotas? Why do we even need them? Does it even matter? In newer versions, when Exchange 2010 came out, we came out with the mailbox, large mailbox sizing vision white paper of how Microsoft sees large mailboxes and how we can address different challenges. Right, so does it even matter? If you want to go with large mailboxes, is it a problem? Or is it okay to go with large mailboxes? And what are some factors that you have to consider? What I do want to highlight is that the mailbox quotas, it's not just an IT decision. So you as an IT, you can't just go forward and say, well, this is the mailbox quota we are going to have, and then users basically live with it. You probably can do that as an IT organization, and sometimes users will live with it, sometimes they won't, and if you have any processes that actually measures the satisfaction with your customers, whether it's external or your users, it probably won't be nice if you just enforce the quotas based on your own decisions. So that's why I want to highlight that it's an IT decision as much as it is a business decision. So, what we're going to talk about? Start with a question or maybe two. Talk about the quota, of course, that's what we're here for. Talk about some more stuff that is relevant. And then I'll leave room, I'll be outside so you can have the Q&A session. Let me rephrase that. That won't work nice. I would be in the room so you can ask me questions, we can have a Q&A. I'll leave about 10 to 15 minutes at the end. If there are any questions that can't wait until end, feel free to ask. I'll stop. If it's something quick, I can answer. As everyone else, I will also remind you to complete the evaluation. It's just important for us to understand how we did, how we can do better, or how we can do worse if I did great. So with the question, think of Microsoft Mail. How many of you go back to Microsoft Mail? A couple hands. That's good. I'm not the only one. Yeah, I started about when I was six. So, what do you think the answer to that question is? Microsoft Mail was first introduced in 1991 for PC networks, 1988 for AppleTalk networks. Either both of them are true, either none of them are true. Anyone? You have the answers, just pick one. All of the above. Well, that's kind of true. It would be true in the context of the question if it was, when was Microsoft Mail introduced, right? But because it's first, I would go with the second answer. 1988, right? That's the first. There is only one first. So it was introduced for Apple Talk Networks in 1988. Yeah, who thought? Who knew? It was sold, became some other product, Quarterdeck Mail, became Star 9, and then it died. All right. I'll leave it at that. It was for Apple Talk. What do you expect? Right. So I want to start with, you know, because we're talking mailbox quota, it's important to understand how the communications are carried out in corporations, whether it's small businesses or large. Where are the communications going? So let's go back all the way to 1965, when the first email was sent. Well, depending on how you look at it, whether it was standard-based or not is a different question, but the first email was sent when it was introduced at MIT. Going forward a few years, ARPANET sent the email that you can say is what we use today as a standards-based email with the different systems talking to each other. 1982, a while from when the first email was sent on ARPANET, is when we decided, well, we should have some standards that everyone would adhere to, right? So we had the 821, which defines the SMTP. Going forward, 2000, Exchange 2000 introduced IM capabilities. How many of you has used that? I have. Yeah, so that was fun, right? Part of Exchange, you had the IM capabilities, you could use that. In 2003, we introduced LCS, Live Communication Server. How many of you support both Exchange and Link, or Exchange and OCS, LCS? Great. All right. So 2003, we introduced that product. A lot of people were using it, and then eventually, you know, it became OCS and Link. 2006, we now had a shift, right? You had Facebook, you had Twitter. You had MySpace. Who remembers MySpace? So, you know, a few of those social networks came about. I'm not even sure if any of you are tweeting about me doing horrible so far. But that's the power of that instant communications, right? You have that. Came about in 2006, became public. I mean, you can debate, you know, when it came about. It's just when it became public is 2006. 2009 is when we introduced Exchange 2010, talking about all the new features, how great they are, and how it's going to make your job easier, right? 2010, we had Link Server RTM. So now your Link Server became RTM, became available, the newest version of LCS, OCS. Introduced a lot of new functionality, very useful. I want to pause for a second and ask, you know, why are we even talking about all these different things that are not necessarily all email? Because it's not just the email that we use anymore, right? How many of you actually use social networking of some kind in your environment? It doesn't even have to be Facebook, right? There are a lot of different ways. I see a few hands. A lot of different ways of communicating. You use IM, you use some internal platforms, you even use SharePoint for that matter, you know, that provides you some capabilities. I think there was a product discussed in, called Office Talk from Microsoft on internet. I never heard of it becoming, you know, public, or we use it as internal. It's, again, something similar to that Twitter internal. Right. So what I'm trying to highlight is it's not just the email we rely on anymore. So with that, let's look at the report going back to 2008. This was presented by Ross Smith in 2008, talking about larger mailboxes of Exchange 2007. And we were talking about the email, how email is used. And look at those numbers. What you have is about 156 emails a day for a user send and receive. The independent analyst firm, Radicati, that's referenced here, predicted that by 2012, we will have about 233 messages on an average per person send and receive. So that's quite a difference between 156 going to 233. The increase you see there is about 33% increase from your current as in 2008, right? The other thing I want to highlight is the business users, they were spending about 20% of their time in email, 2007, 2008 timeframe, right? Let's fast forward to 2012 and look at those numbers. Did they go up as expected? They actually dropped. They went to 110 a day. Same analyst firm, their new report from 2012, right? And it's talking about 110 messages a day now. They were expected to be at 233, right? So it just went off a cliff. 110, expected to grow only 130 by 2016. So, while it looks like a large delta, it actually is less in percentage. It's just the way the graph is showing up here, but if you look at this guy, while it doesn't look steeper, it actually is more steeper than the current numbers, right? So looking at these numbers, now we're depending more on other forms of communication. We're using IM, we're using Facebook and Twitter, we're using such internal forms of Facebook and Twitter that allows us to keep it internal if it's business related. And that is actually causing this reduction, right? Now you have less reliance on email. Does that change user behavior of how much they rely on email and how much time they spend in email? Looking at the numbers again, no, we are actually spending about 3 hours a day in email from that independent analysis, right? So we're actually still spending about the same time in emails, whether we're referencing old emails, whether we're maybe paying more attention to the emails coming in now that it's less. How many of you actually agree that the email you receive is less than it was before? I wouldn't expect any hand there. My mailbox is always full. I'm always trying to move the mail around, delete some. All right, so then why are we talking about mailbox quota? You know, why can't we just say everyone have big mailbox, right? Everyone have unlimited mail. Or from 2003, 2007 world, if you had mailbox quotas that were 100 megs or 200 megs, why do we talk about larger mailboxes? Why can't we just stay status quo and say, okay, we are fine there, right? Here's why. Cloud came around. How many of you actually weathered that storm we had a couple days ago? Well, we have rain every day anyway. So the forecast is cloudy, right? Everyone's talking about Google or Microsoft Office 365, some form of cloud, going to cloud. It's going to rain, you know, we better prepare ourselves. We learn Office 365. When you start thinking from the management perspective, we want to save cost. We want to go to some form of cloud. Can we do that? Can we, you know, does our business process support that? Are we okay from security perspective? But then, because we're talking mailbox quota, let's talk about what they offer, right? They offer 25 gig mailboxes at low cost. So now you have this influx from everywhere saying, you know, larger mailboxes is offered with this, is offered with that. That's from the business perspective. If you're a user, you go home and you open your personal mail, whether it's Hotmail, Yahoo, whatever, right? What do you get there? You actually get large quotas there as well. Most of them, as you see, they are soft limits. There is no real hard limit on most of them. Gmail still implements 10 gig. This is right from their website. I'm not trying to single them out. It's just, it is what it is. So even so, those are large numbers, right? Looking at all those numbers, they are big mailboxes. And then it kind of becomes second nature when you go to office with those large mailboxes you have at home, and management talking about cloud, saying, oh, we have these mailboxes from both sides. It comes down to, we have large mailboxes here. Why can't we have it here? Right? So that's the discussion you get into. IT management says, well, why can't we have larger mailboxes? Users say, why can't we have larger mailboxes? And you, as an IT guys, whether you know IT management or IT admins, architects, you're like, we can't just do that. Right? You have to figure out what goes in it. How much you need for the server, memory, storage, processing power, redundancy. You have to account for all that. So taking that aside, what different pieces go into that decision, right? So think about messaging architect. What do they get involved into? They're always talking with business, hey, what do we want, what we should be providing you? And they're thinking from that perspective. They're talking to the business, trying to figure out what works for them. Management is always trying to make sure that they're addressing business needs, as well as, which is the biggest contention, is that how do you stay within allocated budget while meeting business requirements or the user requirements? Legal and security is a totally different ballgame. You have to meet the regulation requirements. You know, if you have the compliance, if you're a financial firm or if you're a pharmaceuticals, you have all those different regulatory affairs that you have to make sure you meet their requirements. If you're one of those lucky few who don't have any legal requirements, you can do whatever you want. You probably still have your security group that is imposing some kind of requirements on you, right? So you have to meet those requirements. And that's why we start talking about larger mailboxes, right? What are the benefits of having a larger mailbox? Anyone? I mean, this is a simple question. It's good. It's larger mailbox, I have to worry less, right, as an end user. If you have a larger mailbox than you used to have, how many of you actually would fill it up? Really? Yeah. If you give me a 25 gig mailbox, I'll probably fill it up. But I see very few hands, which tells me, you know, which goes in line with my personal observation in a lot of customers. You give them the quota, whether it's small or big, there is always that average. You either fill it up, which is, you know, those set of demanding users, or then there are those who really don't care about those non-important messages. They get the messages, they read it, they process it, they delete it, right? It's not always going to fill up your mailboxes. However, it's important to consider what the sizing has to be. When you give the quota, and we will talk about that a little bit later, what you should consider in your different factors you have to account for. The benefits, though, is if you have a larger mailbox, I don't have to worry about where I'm going to keep my data, how much of the important stuff, and I consider everything's important, how much of that I'm going to remove when I hit the limit, how much I'm going to keep, what I'm going to keep. It takes a lot of energy to go through that, remove the stuff I don't need. Sometimes, you know, I'm worried if I'm removing something, whether it's going to be required at a later date and where I'm going to find it. I personally don't use PSTs anymore. I used to. And when I used to, I had multiple PSTs for obvious reason. How many of you remember the PST limitation, right? You have that 2 gig limit, not anymore with the Unicode, but you had that limit. And every time you hit that limit, I started over with a new PST. Now I had more PSTs to my Outlook. Not fun. Plus, anytime my hard drive died or I changed the machine, now I have to move it around, right? What if the hard drive completely died? I better wish I had a backup, And I had lost some PhDs before when I didn't have a backup. You know, as they say, real men don't have backups. So that's one thing, right? Now I don't worry about it. I have a 5 gigabytes mailbox. I keep everything in. I actually just got my warning today saying you were reaching your quota, but that's okay. I can quickly find anything. I'll give you a very quick example of, I was at the Exchange Link booth and somebody came around asking me a question about something that I had known. I just didn't know exactly where to find it. So I pulled up my tablet. I went to my Outlook. I have all my feeds synchronized. So in the Outlook, I just went and did a quick search. And it took me seconds to pull up that result and give him the KB article that was referencing to the problem. So if it's all online, it's indexed. You know, Exchange does a good job of indexing. If you're out of cached mode, your local machine does the indexing. So it's easier to quickly find the data that you need. Reduce the mailbox management is obvious. You know, I don't have to worry about if I had larger quota. Again, I am one of those who fill up the mailbox. So it doesn't apply to me particularly. But I still have to keep doing that management. I wish I didn't. But for most, you know, the average users, if you're not filling up your mailbox, it's less management. You have a larger mailbox. You don't have to really go and manage actively what you're going to keep, what you're going to delete. Saves you that energy and time. And of course, you don't need the PSD files, right? So now that you don't need the PSD file, you as an IT admin, you don't have to worry about users managing their PSDs. You have to back it up or support them if they have it stored on network. Well, that's one of the non-issues, right? Or is it an issue? A lot of people use Citrix, terminal services, all that client virtualization. When you do that, how many of you actually design those environments for Disk.io? You actually don't. You design those for programs running. You design it for processing, memory capacity, because the idea there is to have a lot of users using those, you know, high-end servers instead of using their PCs, and you have less management for updates to the programs and all that. But rarely you are actually planning for Disk.io on those environments, because it's not necessarily the heavy Disk.io. It's the front-end, back-end kind of configurations where your back-end is designed for Disk.io, right? So when you actually start using Outlook in cache mode on that environment, you have the OSD files. People might be using PSDs if you allow that. Then now you also have PSD files. Where do you store those? With those kind of environments, usually your profiles are stored on a network share, right? So when you do that, what happens when you start your Outlook, and if it's the first time or if it's one of the big OSD or PSD files because you have larger mailbox quotas? What are you doing to the disk? Have you accounted for that? The other thing is PSD, OSD. Are they supported on network? No, right? So those are the problems you face. Eliminate the PSD, eliminate that problem, right? IT benefits. Again, some of that we talked about, but you know, high availability is one of them. If you have your data in the mailboxes, mailboxes are under your control, right? I mean, you are the IT admin, you know how your mailbox servers are configured, you know how your DAG, if you're using 2010, is configured, CCR, SCR, if it's 2007, how it's configured, you have control over that. You can configure high availability, you can fail over, you know. So that's easier. If the user's hard drive died, what would you do with their PSDs that they had? They're definitely going to call you, right? Someone, maybe not directly you. Utilize high-capacity disk drives with the larger mailboxes and reduced I/O in 2010, right? You're using the drives more efficiently. You're doing more serialized I/O, not necessarily completely 100% serial I/O, but it's more serialized. It's the larger disks. When you design for disk, how do you design that? Do you design for I/O or do you design for space? Anyone? I/O? Okay. It's a mixture of both. So if you're designing for one, what happens is if you're designing for I/O, you're going to end up having a lot more spindles. You will have a lot more space, which means you could probably have less requirements of the space per se. But because of the I/O requirement, you are now throwing more space at it. What happens to that space? Is anybody who says it goes to waste? One. Okay. Everyone else says it doesn't go to waste, which I tend to agree with. What happens is you see that there is a lot of this space. You start filling it up with the mailboxes. Now what you're doing to your I/O? You actually didn't design for that I/O. You designed for the disk space now, right? Even if you didn't, because you see the space and you start filling up, you actually are using it as if you had all that disk space with all that I/O behind it that you need for all that many mailboxes. So now you start oversubscribing that disk. So it's a balance of both. It's not just the I/O or the disk sizing, right? And larger mailboxes help you with that. If you have a larger mailbox, now you're using that disk space without adding more mailboxes to it. Now that you're not adding more mailboxes to it, your I/O profile doesn't change because the user is going to use that 110 or 156, whatever messages a day. That's not going to change per user, right? So as long as you keep that the same for the designed I/O, you're not oversubscribing the disk, but you're using more space efficiently. Reduces user overhead because when you have to support those users for a lot of calls, larger mailboxes, lesser calls, hopefully, right? So, and elimination of PSTs. Why do we keep talking about elimination of PSTs? You have probably heard it way too many times ever since we had 2010 or even before then, right? Get rid of PSTs. Why? The backup issue that we talked about, you know, I lost my PSTs. When I lost it, what did I do? Well, I was IT pro, so I didn't care. I lost it, and I cried a little bit in my corner, you know, and got over it. But users won't do that. They would actually pick up the phone and call you. Hey, I lost my disk. Can you recover that? You say no, and they say it's very important. Can we even, you know, spend some money and send the disk to someone so they can recover it? And then you say no, and then they go to their manager. I mean, it's the support that you have to deal with. Large PST performance issues. When you have PSTs that are Unicode, now we support large PSTs, 25 gig, 50 gig, you know, whatever. And if it is that large, now it's a performance problem because where do those PSTs sit usually? On your local machines, local disks. How fast are those disks? You're carrying a laptop, right? You have something like this, assuming it's not SSD. You don't really have a very fast disk. What ends up happening is that you basically start having the perf issues. You see that you're issuing a search in your PST and it takes a long time. Sometimes Outlook freezes. So all those problems, you want to, you know, if you get rid of PST, you get rid of that problem. Legal is a big issue. Anytime, how many of you actually had to do some kind of search and provide the results to your lawyer or to your security team? Pretty much everyone, right? What's the process? How many of you actually just export the whole mailbox and give it to your security or legal? A few. So, how many of you now actually go and ask the user if they have PST? Or without asking, actually just search their machine and find the PST and give data from there to the legal? One. I mean, from percentage-wise, it might be, you know, maybe 1%. It's difficult. How do you know user has PST? How do you get to it? How do you get the data out of it? It's difficult. So when you have the data, it becomes a problem. Try becoming a lawyer and argue that I didn't get it from PST, but the PST is there. Or say, I don't know if the PST is there. How would that go? Probably not very well. So have you considered the PST capture tool yet? Have you tried it? Have you seen it? Have you seen the blog post about it? How many? Good. Okay. So That tool actually is designed to help you find the PSTs and in some form or fashion actually capture it, grab it, and then take your second step of importing it in your environment if you need to in the mailboxes directly. So it's a recent addition to our tool set. If you haven't tried it, go ahead and try it. But the point is, you know, there are different ways of finding it. You might be using SCCM and running the reports. Let's talk about the planning. How do you plan for mailboxes, whether large or small, right? What are the factors that you have to consider? Quite a few. The first thing is profile. I always look at the profile of the users. If you're not looking at that, you probably are missing half of your right design decisions that you're going to make for the mailboxes. How many mails am I sending and receiving? What's our average user mail flow? How much are they sending? How much they're receiving? It's relatively easy to find out in your current environment if you're planning for an upgrade or even getting the new servers in to replace the old ones. You could easily look at your, you know, your logs and run some analysis on that to figure out what your mail flow is average per user. It's important because I want to show you those in the tables below. What we have taken is two averages. One is 50, which is 50 mails per day, send and receive. The other one is 150. Look at the difference. You have the 50 with the average size of 50 kilobytes per message. In a day, you're generating 2.4 megabytes, assuming that you never get rid of any data. An average design lifespan for your servers is about 3 years. Right, and again, that's average. You could be buying the servers and keeping them forever, and at 5-6 years, it's too old. But otherwise, you know, let's just say we're planning for 3 years. How big will that mailbox get? About two gigabytes, right? Now look at the other one, 150. Three times? Not necessarily. So the When you're sending more items and receiving more items, chances are you're one of those heavy users. Chances are your mail is not averaging the same size as the lighter users, right? So 75K heavy profile user. Now, all of a sudden, at end of 3 years, your mailbox doesn't look like 2 gigabytes. It looks more like 12 gigabytes, right? So that's, you know, one thing you must consider. Message size, mailbox profile, SLA requirements. So how many of you have SLAs that are signed and approved by your business stakeholders, which says, you know, this is what we provide, this is how much we will make sure the exchange stays up, or, you know, this is how much data we'll make sure is always available. How many of you have those SLAs? Few hands, which is good. I would like to see more, but I understand the complexities of those. The point is, though, if you have SLAs, you have to meet those requirements. Sometimes they are not the signed and, you know, set in stone kind of SLAs. It's just some understanding between business and IT. So even if you don't have SLAs, you always have SLAs. So there were only few who said, you know, we have SLAs. But in general, how many of you actually have never filtered the question why the exchange was down or when it's going to be up? None, right? Every one of you have filtered the question sometime or other. So even if you don't have SLAs, people are expecting that you meet some soft SLA. Understand what that requirements are. What's your retention? That goes along with the legal and discovery. What's your retention requirement? If the user deletes something, how do you make sure that's not gone? How do you retain that information, right? And what do you need for that? So let's take an example of how we did it at MSIT. I want to start with this disclaimer. When we talk MSIT, take this with a grain of salt or two, right? Because MSIT is a very unique environment. So what I'm going to talk about doesn't necessarily mean you have to do that. It's just that understand how we did it, why we did it, and maybe learn a thing or two from that. The first thing I want to talk about, boring, MSF, right? How many of you have heard about MSF, Solutions Framework from Microsoft? We talk about the processes before technology, right? It's important that you follow some kind of methodology to come up with your solutions. Now, it's easy to say Exchange is easy. I just run the setup. I have the server. I know it's big enough to take whatever amount of users you have, and here you have it. Just start using it. It's easy to do that. But how many of you actually were involved in the discussions with business when you were designing your email environment, whether you were doing an upgrade or whether you were just doing a greenfield? Wow, only two, maybe three. That's interesting. It's something that you should be doing, right? Now, maybe it's probably because you're not messaging architects. Maybe that's why, and it's okay if you're not, and that's probably why you're not involved in that decisions, that's fine. But as an organization, you should have that process. Now, I was personally involved in a lot of those discussions with businesses previously with different applications, not necessarily the email applications. But then when I started working with the customers at Microsoft, we did get involved in those decisions. And there are very few organizations who actually don't go through this process, not necessarily in an efficient way, but either way. What I want to highlight is that business part, right? That's why I have it underlined. Make sure you involve business. If not, you're bound to fail because you're just setting something up that you have no idea how business wants to use it, right? What we started with in assessment and scoping phase, which is the first phase for the design, you start with what are our goals? Where are we going with this solution? What do we want to do? Increase employee productivity, increase operational efficiency. These were the two big ones for us. Of course, decrease the cost. Who doesn't want to do that, right? Started with that, and we started diving into the deeper technological aspect of it, and we said, okay, what do we want to do with mailboxes? And since we were talking about mailbox quota, I won't go into all the other decisions, but for the mailbox, right, what are we going to do? So we decided, let's go to 5 gigabytes. How did we come up with that? Here's the hat, pull one number out, it works. No, what we did is we looked at numbers. We looked at what we have in our environment today. How are users using their email? How many they're receiving every day? How many they're sending every day? What's their current mailbox size? Given that mailbox profile, how much they're going to have in 3 years? We designed for 3-year cycles. So how much they are going to be at in 3 years? How big their mailbox is going to be? And then leave some room for, you know, those users who don't adhere to average like me, fill up the mailbox. It was necessary to, you know, sustain the growth because we, like I said, we are unique. Now, I'm not saying you're not relying on your email, but we heavily rely on our email. So, you know, increase reliance on email while using all the other technologies like Twitter and Facebook. We wanted 5 gig mailboxes. The other requirement was use low-cost storage. Why? Because Exchange 2010 was built around it. If we don't use it, how would we tell you to use it? Right? We have to use it. We have to prove that it works. We are one of the largest environments that is, you know, our own customer in that sense. And we proved it by doing that. So in design phase, we said, well, if this is what we are going to, we should prove it, and let's go with that. The other goal was to remove third-party backups and reliance on that. Again, remember what I said, right? We are very unique. So if you're going with this, understand whether it works for you or not, what your requirements are. Use native features. So we wanted to use the native features, lagged copies, dumpster 2.0. So our configuration goals, we were sizing for storage, right? And not necessarily we were sizing only for storage, but when we were sizing for storage, we said, how are our users look like? Existing mailbox sizes, 890 megabytes on an average in 2008 when we started looking at 2010 design. User profile, 100 to 150 mail send and receive per day. Growth rate about 60 megabytes. So we were growing at that rate a month for a user. So now you can do a simple math and say in 3 years we're going to be here. Right? Account for overhead, because in Exchange 2010, how many of you read the post from Ross Smith talking about version store when we were talking about dumpster? It was recent on the Exchange team blog. If you haven't, it's very informative. Definitely take a few minutes to read it. But it talks about how the mailbox dumpster stores the versions, especially when you have single item recovery enabled and whatnot. So we wanted to keep deleted items for 30 days. Content indexing is another overhead that you have to account for, because content indexing makes it easier and faster actually to search when you go online through OWA or in the online mode of Outlook. Average number of transaction logs per user. Why are we thinking that as an overhead? Because we were going with JBOD, and when you go with JBOD, usually your design is single database per disk, so you have your database and log files on the same disk, so you have to account for that, right? So with those numbers, our projected mailbox came out to be about 3 gigabytes in 3 year time frame that we were projecting for. Our formatted capacity. So we started looking at different disks. We said, well, we have 1 gigabyte disks. 2 gigabytes came around after, and we actually use them now as well. But starting with the design, we looked at the 1 terabyte disk, 7200 RPM. And we said, okay, so what do we have? With 1 terabyte disk, we have about 917 formatted capacity. How many mailboxes can we fit in it? About 300, 305. Okay. So let's go with that. This is the space aspect of the disk, right? We talked about filling the space. Now that we filled the disk, let's look at the I/O and see if you're designing for I/O correctly as well. So 7200 RPM, how many IOPS do we get? So the disks that we had, we were getting about, you know, 100 IOPS within that response time requirements of 20 MS. If you go above that, you start seeing issues. So how many mailboxes can we fit in 100 IOPS? You need to understand what your average IOPS per user is. And we looked at that from current environment, and we saw that it was about 0.3. Now, did we compare that from 2007? You could. That probably won't be very accurate, but it would give you a ballpark, right? What we did, though, is we had that pre-deployment that we looked at. So we had the very early versions of 2010 in our, if you go back to MSF, we have the phase where we actually tested very early in the process, and that's where we observed 0.3 average IOPS per user as well. So we went with that, counting that with 305 mailboxes from the space aspect that we had derived. It looks like 91 IOPS. Well, we fit within that 100 IOPS frame, so we're okay. The remaining 8.5 or 9 IOPS aren't necessarily too much for overhead. You would like 20% overhead. This is giving you about 10%. But when you go with that kind of design, you have to understand how operationally mature you are, right? Monitoring, your staff training, all that. How is that working for you, and whether it's efficient or not? Because if you're not, your reaction time would be longer. You don't want to start having problems. It worked for us, so we went with that. If you're using RAID, the calculations won't be just this simple, right? You can't just do this many times this many mailboxes equals that, because when you have RAID, you have RAID penalties. When you're writing with RAID 5, the penalties are different than when you're writing with RAID 1. Reading is always one-to-one. The other factor with RAID is when you're doing a rebuild, if one of the disks fails, you pull it out, put the new one in, now you have that performance penalty as well. So just keep that in mind. How do you account for that? Use Ross's calculator. That's what it's for. It accounts for all that. So the config goals, you know, we started looking at, now you move on from storage to memory sizing and talk about how much memory we're going to have. I'm not going to talk about that too much, but let's just go over very quickly. The ESC cache. You have OS requirement. Then you have exchange requirement, and the remaining memory is used by ESE. So if you have a 48 gigabytes of memory in your server, ESA will just take up the rest and start ramping up the user. So given the number of users, you would have X amount of cash per user. What did we need from MSIT? 100 messages per day required about 6, 150 required about 9. Our average profile was in between somewhere, right? So we needed about, let's say, upper range of 9 megabytes of cash per user. Count that out from the OS and Exchange requirements of 2 and 4 gigabytes that we observed. 32 gig server and 64 gig server are the two that we actually looked at. And 32 gig met our requirements, so we went with that. So now we have a server, 32 gig memory. Again, I didn't talk about processor. We don't need to. We were talking about mailbox quota. 1 terabyte, 7200 RPM disk, 35 disks per server, and 5 gig quota, right? The oh wait moment is because so far we talked about 3 gigabytes, right? A couple slides ago I said it's 3 gigabytes is what we expected it to grow to. We're giving them the quota of 5 gigabytes. What does that mean? Thin provisioning. Because we were saying, you know, our disk is 1 terabyte, 305 mailboxes, grow to 3 gigabytes, it's fine. Grow to 5 gigabytes, it's not fine, right? You will run your space over. You won't have enough space to fill all those mailboxes. So that's where, when you talk about thin provisioning, again, remember my comments from before, what we did is not necessarily what you want to do. But thin provisioning is something that I personally don't like because there are a lot of trade-offs. When you're doing thin provisioning, you have to understand a lot of complexities involved with that. How is thin provisioning, you know, done? Whether is it the way we did it is we said, okay, we are going to have 1 terabyte disk. We have this many users. When we fill it up, we will either move the users to a different place and, you know, analyze what we need to do. We don't wait until fill it up, but again, it's the monitoring process. One of the thin provisioning deployments that I have seen is where you're doing it from the SAN side. So SAN says we are thin provisioned, but when you look at it from the server side, you actually see the full size of the disk that you planned for. So let's say you plan for 5 gigabytes times 300 mailboxes, whatever that comes out to be. It's going to be a little more than 1 terabyte, right? From SAN perspective, it shows you have that much space. In the back end, though, it's thin provision, so you don't actually have that many disks in the back end. What happens? When you're monitoring, your monitoring tools on the server shows you have that space. Do you actually have that? No. How do you know you're filling up that space to whatever it is thin provision to? It becomes challenging. So just keep that in mind. If you go with thin provisioning, you have to account for all this. It's not going to be as simple as, oh, I'm looking at the disk space, it's filled up, so I will add more disk. It's not that simple, right? All right, backup strategy. Support 5 gig mailboxes, use the built-in tools, Dumpster 2 and whatnot. So what did we do with that is we went with lag database copy, single item recovery. We enabled all those different features, right? How many of you know enough about Dumpster 2.0? In 2010? A few? Okay, good. We have a slide, so I'll talk briefly about that as well. But we started with that, and we said if you use the lagged copy, we can use the lagged copy to go back up to 14 days and restore from that for any given point in time. And then we have single item recovery, so if user deletes something and it's purged, so users are used to that shift delete, which basically purges it. You can go back and recover those single items as admins. They won't be able to see it in their recover deleted items, right? So that's your dumpster tool right there. What you used to have before 2010 was just that gray area up top. You had your mailbox, you had your deleted items. You can delete something, goes to deleted items, users can recover it. If your user goes there and actually empties that, now at that time, those items are gone. Right? If it was in deleted items and deleted, not hard deleted with the shift delete, you as an admin still had ability to somehow retain that items, not necessarily export them. With Dumpster 2.0, what we did is we added some more functionality into it. When you do the hard deletes, when you do the shift delete, right, it goes to the versions in Dumpster 2.0. It goes into deletions there instead of actually being completely purged. So you have the purges, you have the versions, you have the deletions. Deletions are the soft deletes, right? Purges are the ones that you actually purged as a user, shift deletes. Versions are when you open, let's say, a calendar item, and then you change something in it and save it. It saves a version of the older item and then saves the changes in your calendar. So those are the versions. And it helps you actually with these in the discovery process. Because with these, now admin has that ability to go in and help user even if they did the shift delete. Or think of the legal discovery reasons when somebody says, well, user tried to hide their tracks by deleting it completely thinking it's purged. It's not actually purged. The key there is that single item recovery was enabled in part of our process. Right? Some of that is retained, some of them is not. You still have the purges. So when you delete, let's say the single item recovery is not enabled. When you delete an item, it still goes to deletions. If you purge, it still goes to purges. But then it's removed from there based on your retention. Default is, I think, 14 days. It's something you can set. And then if you enable single item recovery, it stays there for the amount of time that you define. We decided to set it to 30 days to meet our requirements. How do you recover those? For the single item recovery, there are two different ways of doing it. If you want to export it to PST, you have a commandlet there. If you want to actually put it in someone's mailbox, either it's admin mailbox or user's own mailbox when you're restoring it for them, you use search mailbox commandlet. The only thing I want to highlight, I don't want to tell you how to use the commandlet, but I want to highlight that search dumpster switch. If you don't specify that, it will not actually bring items from dumpster. It will only bring it from the deleted item. So just understand that. Okay, so let's talk about the challenges a little bit. When you go to large mailboxes, what are the challenges? Server performance, client impact, operations management. This is a big one, right? What's its impact on operations? Like, how would you manage your servers? What would it mean if it was larger mailboxes? Does it change anything for you? How does it work with the disaster recovery? So let's talk about the server performance. Previous versions, your I/O requirements were kind of linear, right? If your mailbox grew, your I/O requirements grew with it. And that posed challenges of whether the disks were designed for it or not. 2010, a couple things are working for us, right? It's a 64-bit application, so it has a different profile. I/O is reduced because we have done some changes in how the cache is handled on the server, how your I/O is done with the writes that are coalesced and their, you know, lazy writes, all these different new technologies that we introduced in 2010. Checkpoint depths, so how much we keep in memory before we commit it to the disk. All that's working for you, so that's reducing your I/O. Number of items in folder increases as the mailbox size increases. How many of you have actually hit those issues where you have the search issues or, you know, the views that users are pulling and they have a lot of items and you had to tell them they had too many items in their inbox? With 2010, it is helping you with what? What's the new number? Does anyone remember? Sorry? 100,000. It's a huge number, right? I mean, 2003, we had only 5,000 to 100,000, it's a big jump. Now we support that large number in your inbox, so it's working for you. What you can also do is you can use the throttling. If you have the users who are actually using resources more than the other users, you could use throttling to manage that workload a little bit and address that the server stays at the acceptable performance overall for all the users. When we talked about the large mailboxes and, you know, you have the Unicode that supports large PSTs now, thinking in that sense, large mailboxes when you have, we're not talking PST, but what we're talking about is you have a user who's running cache mode, they will still have the OST on their machine, right? What happens with certain type of mailboxes. So this is, again, straight from our guidance. 5 gigabytes, you have a good user experience up to 5 gigabytes. The reason is, you know, we are relying on local disk if you're cached mode. And if you're online mode, then you're actually going to the server generating your views, so it still takes the processing cycles. Between 5 and 10 gigabytes, typically hardware dependent, how fast is your hardware? We're talking cache mode, right? More than 10 gigabytes, you start seeing some issues and freezes and such. You have short pauses when you do the search or when you actually switch from a folder to folder. 25 gig and larger, now you start seeing issues. You start seeing freezes. Again, it really depends on your hardware. How fast is your hardware? How fast is your disk? It's not just the disk, right? It's your processing, memory, everything. Operational. What are the challenges with operational? What do you have to do to maintain that environment, right? What's your backup times going to be? Will you be able to meet your backup windows? Would your backups finish in whatever your backup window is? What about log generation? When you move your users, how frequently do you move your users from a database to another? Or how many times, you know, you move if you're in the middle of migration? How many users are you going to move every night? You have to account for that log space as well, right? Restoration, how long it is going to restore? When you do that restore, is it going to be within your recovery time objective? RTO, right? Are you going to meet that window of restore? Is it going to be within that window? Consider that. So if you look at all these different moving pieces, the key is to balance all of them. If you strike a balance, it's going to be a very good deployment. It's going to be something that will let you sleep at night, right? So management. Requires dedicated storage if you were using SAN. We decided to not use SAN. Is it okay to use SAN? How many? Of course, yes. It's okay to use SAN, right? What's the complexity? What do you need? Do you have that investment in the personal, in the technology? It's not the discussion, and there are a lot of times, you know, I have storage vendors come up to me and say, so why do you not like SAN? And I'm like, I never said I don't like SAN. It's the matter of making a decision of what's cost effective to you, whether it makes sense for you to go that way, what's the impact of performance, you know, how you're going to design your SAN. You could design it in a very good way and you will have the performance you need. What's the cost impact? Are you going to be within your cost requirements? And if it fits all those bands, then use it, by all means. The thing is, though, it has a lot of moving parts. How many of you actually tried to troubleshoot an issue that seemed to be, you know, something disk-related and it was SAN, and then you had to go through, you know, troubleshooting all those different moving pieces and it took a long time? Right? Yeah. It's just because of the complexity you have. It just needs careful planning, both for the SAN, and it doesn't only apply to SAN, it actually applies to your local storage too. It just requires careful planning. Same for thin provisioning. Stop beating the dead horse with the thin provisioning, right? Installation requirements when we talk about DES, how do you go about that? You have to consider the space in your data center. So some data centers I have seen have space and they put whatever needs to go wherever. So you have these different racks, you have a server that goes with DES which has its own enclosure, you have space. There are some environments I have seen where they have dedicated storage space. So the storage has to go there and your servers have to go in your server rack, primarily because it was decided at one point that most of your storage that's going to be out of your box is going to be in SAN. Well, if that's the case, now you ask them for the DES enclosures going in the same rack with your server, it's not going to work, right? So what's your different factors implementing that? How are you going to perform your backups? With SAN, if you're using the third-party software or even their replication technology that a lot of SAN vendors offer, if you were using that, you could do disk to disk in the back end. The same frame, you have this different set of disks, it does it in the back end, you don't even know about it. With DAS, how are you going to take that backup now? It has to go over LAN. So just account for that. Reliability. Since we are talking more DAS now and you know JBuds that we did at MSIT, if you were doing that, how do you account for reliability? Is it reliable enough? In our experience, yes, it is. All the newer disks that are server class, enterprise grade, the failure rate is just about the same as your SAS drives or the fiber channel drives, right? And that's just right from our own experience from the white paper where we documented all this. What's the benefit? It's cheaper. What's the benefit with 2010? It actually works with it, and it's designed for that lower I/O requirements. So with SATA, if you go with SATA, pay attention to the enclosure specs. Heat, vibration causes issues. So if you're within the specs, you're fine. If you're a gas drilling or maybe oil company, most of your places are in these data centers that are not necessarily the sophisticated data centers, but you have these locations that are remote and not necessarily the best locations for the equipment that you see. And what do you do with that? Do you have those vibrations? Do you have that heat that you usually don't see in other data centers? Every environment is unique, right? So just account for your environment and see if those meets your specifications or you meet their specifications. If not, you're ultimately going to be outside of their supported range. You're going to have issues. CapEx and OpEx, capital expense, which is, you know, the purchase cost if you're purchasing a server, purchasing a storage, and then the OpEx, which is the support cost of replacing the disks that fail. How are you going to account for that? CapEx, obviously, your SATA, JBOD, DAS, that tends to come out cheaper than the SAN, right? Replacement cost for OpEx, usually, referring to the previous slide, we talked about the pod design, right? So if you have a server with DAS, usually you just have that and the amount of disk, let's say you have it filled up. Now you cannot add more disks. It's basically a pod of the amount of users you designed it for. So adding more capacity means adding another pod, another server, another set of storage. Same with your operational cost. What happens at that time is usually you have it completely filled up. The only thing at that point is maintenance of something going wrong, right? If it's a direct connect, how much maintenance you think it is over 3 years? What do you really maintain? Just the disks that fail, right? Chances of the controller failing or the cable failing are very rare compared to the disk itself failing. So you just really replace the disk. That's not that much of an overhead. So it saves you money there. So we're at almost 10 minutes, and I think I timed it well. In conclusion, you know, what should be your mailbox quota? You came here for mailbox quota, so you know, finally, I think we come to the point where we say, what should be your mailbox quota? Is there a single answer? No. Sorry if I disappointed you there. There isn't a single answer, right? These are all the moving pieces you have to account for. Account for those pieces. Hopefully, you know, what I gave you gives you enough ammunition to understand what you have to account for, how you address that. Know your average growth, know your mailbox sizes, know your I/O profiles. Understand your business requirements first, and then, of course, the IT requirements. Understand the budgets, whether your design fits into that or not. Understand your operational maturity. How is your monitoring today? Is it working for you? Are you missing the alerts? You know, are you operationally mature? I would like to say, you know, everyone is, but only you can say whether you are or not. Understand how, you know, these different technologies, you know, IAM and social media, how it's helping or working against you. Because you could be using the feeds, and now all of a sudden what you're doing on your IAM and Facebook, you could be pulling it in to Outlook with the feeds, and now you think you're reducing the size, you're actually increasing it, So understand how it's being used by the users. All right. And just, you know, a couple other talking points that I won't repeat, we have talked about. With that couple of sessions, we have 308, which is in this room right after we are done. Robert Gillis is actually presenting that, so I'm not Robert Gillis, if you haven't noticed. It's a good session. There are a couple other sessions I've referenced here. Hands-on labs, if you haven't tried that, lets you play with the technology, different topics that are there. And then if you want to talk to me afterwards, you can find me at the Exchange and Link booth between 11:30 and 2. I will start taking questions. Just one more thing that I want to remind, though, well, actually two, is Mac is back, and don't tell me why we did it this way. It's not my decision, but it is what it is. It's going to be very informative. We are going to talk a lot about Exchange 15, but at the same time, we are also going to talk a lot about Exchange 2010 and all the other relevant topics as well. So if you can make it, we'd love to see you there. And don't forget to fill out my evaluation. Just tell me how I did. It's very important for me, and it's very important for you because you could win one of these things. All right, so with that, I'll take questions. Feel free to use the mic. It's easier that way. We can record. Other people can hear you. Doesn't have to be mailbox quota questions. You can ask me if I'm going to give you ice cream. Go ahead.
Aside from the size of the mailbox, is there an optimal size for the database? And if the database is reaching a certain size, should we be creating new databases?
So it depends on how you actually size your disks. Let me repeat the question if it wasn't audible. The question is, you know, with certain database sizes, so if you're reaching certain size of the database, when do you decide to create a new database? There isn't really a single answer to that question, but it really depends on how you designed your storage. If it's for I/O, if you're hitting that I/O limit, then you would start with a new database. If you design for JBOD and you're reaching the disk capacity on that JBOD disk, if it's a 1 terabyte, then when you're at 20% of the free space, you want to leave that overhead, start with a new database. So it really comes down to unique environmental factors, but hopefully, you know, that helps you a little bit. Any other questions? You know where to find me. Thank you very much again. Thank you.